This is Julie Stanford of Essential Business Radio. A few years ago, I was lucky enough to present a show called Business as Usual for Radio Reverb in Brighton. And I still think that a number of these shows are very useful for businesses today. Business is about people, creating the right relationships with customers, suppliers, and, most importantly, employees. But with these employees comes legislation. In this episode, I talk to Rebecca Thornley-Gibson of ASB Law and Matthew Penfold of ACAS about an employer's responsibilities and your employees' rights. Welcome to the two of you.
Hello. Good afternoon.
Now, normally I have three guests on this part of the show, but today we've decided to have two experts because really the subject we're covering is one that I know causes sleepless nights to many business owners. And I'm really thrilled that both of you have agreed to come in and help us negotiate our way through the minefield that is employment. So we're going to have you here for two shows. The first show, what I'd love to cover is really the difference between the myth and the reality of employment legislation. You know, as an employer, we all have responsibilities, we know that, and we know that our employees have various rights. But I think between those two areas, there's a great big grey fog where we think maybe there are dragons in there, actually, that we're thinking that something is so and it isn't, and you must both listen and hear these stories and just laugh sometimes. I mean, Rebecca and I were talking about before coming on the show about the fact that as employers, we have a duty of care. We are running businesses. We should therefore be taking this very seriously. There is legislation which states that we must do things in a particular way. But I think a lot of the confusion arises from ignorance. Mm. And so if you could help dispel these myths or put us right on the kind of things that you know employers are thinking, which is not necessarily true, I think it would be great for today's show. So let's start then and think about, as the general responsibilities of an employer, if you were, you know, advising an employer, what would you be making sure they were very aware of, Rebecca?
Well, I think if you start from the foundations of actually having a contract which sets out the expectations between the employer and the employee, and the expectations both ways as well, and with that contract as well, a job description, so that the employee actually knows what they're meant to be doing. One word of caution, though, about a job description is that it shouldn't be so inflexible that if the employee is asked to do something else, they've got some sort of potential get out from doing that because it's not in my job description. So I think that contractual position needs to be set out, and it's a legislative requirement anyway to have a statement of terms and conditions, statement of particulars given to the employee. And also, if things do start to go wrong further down the line, it means the employer can at least point to something in the contract and say, well, you were meant to do this or you weren't meant to do that. Small employers tend not to perhaps have a staff handbook, but that doesn't stop them from having some kind of policies that might suit their business.
So if you haven't written it down, you can't then say to someone, by the way, you haven't done that, if you haven't drawn their attention to the fact that you wanted them to do it in the first place.
No, it is very difficult. And the classic example probably on that is something like use of the computer at work. So if you don't have a computer misuse policy, or a computer use policy or some sort of data protection policy, it is quite difficult then to say to an employee, I'm sorry, but you shouldn't have spent your time between 11 o'clock and half past 11 surfing for your holiday. So if you do have a policy and there are acceptable usage conditions in there, everybody knows what they're allowed to do. Mm. And hopefully, you know, that's to the benefit of the employee and that they see there's a little bit of flexibility and the employer knows where they can then draw the line.
So would you expect, this is a stupid question maybe, but would you expect the employee sometimes to be included in that negotiation originally? Or would you just say, these are our terms and conditions, or this is your contract, this is your job description? It seems to me it might be quite a reasonable thing to do to just get to ask their opinion of that, to make sure that you both agree and you're both aware of the edges of it, I suppose, if you know what I mean.
Best practice should be to consult about as much as possible that's going to affect the employee in the workplace. Mm. And employees won't tend to be consulted when they start about the contract that they're given.
No.
Although they, because they, of course, have an option as to whether to sign it and start work in the first place. Mm. But once they've started work, if the employer then wishes to change the contract, they will need to consult over it and they will need to get the employee's consent in the vast majority of cases to change terms and conditions. When it comes to policies that are not necessarily contractual but are expectations of behaviours in the workplace, then consultation is going to result in the employee probably adopting those policies with a slightly more harmonious attitude than if it's just thrust upon them.
Mm-hmm. So, Matt, would you think, does that ring bells with you? I mean, are you
Very much so, yes. I'd echo what Rebecca's saying there, and I agree that the contract that's put on the table when somebody's taking up employment is probably mostly within the gift of the employer to set out. And yes, if you then go on and need to or want to, for whatever reason, which a lot of employers are doing at the moment, if you want to amend that contract of employment, you need to, if you're following best practice, change it by agreement with the employee.
Right.
Now, that's if it's possible to reach agreement with the employee, of course. But if you can't reach agreement with the employee, that's not the end of the story, as Rebecca will no doubt tell us more about that. You know, an employer can decide, if business reasons demand it, that it needs to unilaterally make changes to an employment contract. It just needs to do that in the right way. So contracts aren't untouchable once they're signed, if business needs demand it, but you need to know the right ways to go about it. And I'm sure that all employment lawyers and ACAS advisors will be able to advise employers on the, on those right methods. The policies and procedures angle is very important. I mean, ACAS tries not to spout the letter of the law all the time. We're very much about talking of good practice. But there's not much getting away from the fact that some basic policies and procedures are the nuts and bolts of a well-run, effective company that can manage its people. So I am a great believer in employees being involved in setting those policies and procedures, because very much as Rebecca says, if you help create the rules, you're more likely to live with them. There's less likelihood of any kind of sabotage, and employees understand the rationale for those rules having been set down as well.
Mm. So Rebecca, given what Matt was saying then about if you want to make a change to the contract subsequently, what would be the way you would advise an employer to go about doing that?
Well, first of all, you would set out why you want the change. Perhaps something's happened in the business that means that it's necessary to add an additional clause into a contract. For example, it might be that you want to add a particular restrictive covenant, a restraint of trade clause into a contract, because you've just been hurt by the fact that two of your people have just left to set up a rival business. You didn't have restrictive covenants in your contract, and you feel that actually it's something that you're missing. So you go out to your employee and you propose that this will be an additional part of the contract. Now, those employees may turn around and say, well, sorry, but I don't really like that because I don't want to be restrained, particularly when I leave employment with you. And if the employees say no, we're not going to agree to that change, as an employer, you would have to decide whether you're going to take the nuclear option, effectively, which is to terminate the contracts they currently have and then offer to re-engage them on the new terms and conditions, which include the new restrictive covenant, for example. Mm. Now, you'd have to make sure that you'd given the employees plenty of time to think about it. You'd have to make sure, as I said before, you've explained why you needed to change this and why it hurts the business for this particular clause not to be there.
So you'd that's have going to show, back to what Matt was saying about the reasonable business conditions.
Absolutely. Which, yeah. You'd have to show that there's a real prejudice to the business by not having particular clauses in the contract.
So something like a restrictive covenant would be a good one, because it's clear why that might be a problem.
Yes.
Particularly if you've had previous experience of employees doing just that.
Yes.
And I had a very real example before leaving to come to the show tonight. There's a company that got in touch with me on the telephone this afternoon. They need to make a decision in the very near future. We're talking about the next 7 to 9 days about how they're going to save X thousands of pounds a year. And they're tossing a coin between considering whether or not to make a redundancy or to seek some input from their employees. And by input, I guess we're really talking a bit of code here for whether or not employees would take a pay cut. There's a lot of that going on. Now, I urged consideration of that latter option, and I think they will pursue that path. What you're attempting to do there is reach an agreement with employees to change the rate of pay, you know, a fundamental part of any employment contract. But if employees will agree to lower their pay levels, then this can be a very valuable alternative option for an employer and can guarantee jobs for the near to medium term future. It might not always be the answer, you know, if you need to make a long term permanent change. But in times of recession, certainly there are more and more companies that are going down that road, and there are a lot of employees that are quite happy to give this consideration. I say quite happy, I might be setting that a bit too high, but they can see the sense in keeping jobs at the expense of a slight reduction in pay. Mm.
Okay, so Rebecca, then thinking what Matt just said, what would then be the reasonable steps that an employer should be taking? Actually, what do they have to do? So they've spoken to the employee, they're trying to get the buy-in. Hopefully, they're going to get it. What happens then? What's the next stage?
If they don't get the buy-in,
yeah,
then they will have to make a decision as to whether they enforce the change, in which case there will potentially be a breach of contract situation, which could leave the employee in a position whereby they bring an action in respect of the pay cut for an unlawful deduction from wages. The employee could potentially resign and claim what's called constructive dismissal and say, you breached my contract, so I'm not going to continue working. In the current climate, most employers know that's probably not going to happen because of the difficulty of getting another job at the moment. So there's some bargaining power on the part of the employer at the moment when it comes to making efficiencies, such as pay cuts. The employer might decide that, well, we're going to enforce the change by actually terminating the employee's contract and offering them re-employment, re-engagement under a new set of terms and conditions which will have the reduced pay, and the employee then has the option as to whether to take that. Now, we tend to call that the nuclear option because we would hope that before it gets to that stage, there will have been enough dialogue between the employer and the employee that they can have come to a pragmatic solution. Because once you have to terminate somebody's employment contract just so they will accept a change, you've lost an awful lot of trust and confidence between the parties in the relationship.
It would be difficult to get back from that point, wouldn't it, to get that strong relationship back.
It's very difficult. And then you have a demotivated set of employees working at a lower pay rate. Productivity is not going to be what it ought to be. And it's probably only a matter of time before those employees start looking around for another job to find a pay rate that's more acceptable, or an employer that doesn't enforce changes on them in the manner that employer has done.
Mm. So let's think then, because if there's one area of business, as I said earlier, that is just full of myths, it's got to be this whole area of employment legislation. So both of you are very experienced in this area. What are the kind of things that you hear employers, or for that matter, employees saying that are not correct and that you must be frustrating for you? Because you're dealing in facts, in clarity, and it must be frustrating when you hear all of us bandying around these stupid things. I mean, I said one to you, Matt, when I was on the phone inviting you to come on the show.
Yes,
that one of my employees had said to me, which I had believed was true, about making a telephone call to me. The employee had said to me that he'd been on the internet, and he said to me, if I ring you at home, that's okay, but if you ring me at home, that can be thought of as harassment. And I was really shocked. But when I said that to Matt, he just said, no, actually, that's not true. So there was I, you know, labouring under the misperception that was true. Matt?
Well, Julie, I mean, on that, I mean, of course, if you phone your employee at home and start screaming obscenities down the phone, then probably that is going to be harassment. But I don't think we were talking about that sort of approach.
No, I wouldn't.
No,
I'm
it is one
nice.
Of my one of my bete noirs, actually, that employers will say, oh, we're not allowed to get in touch with anybody that's off sick, you know. And in fact, for me, that has completely the opposite effect. That will actually make things worse. If you've got somebody off, particularly on long-term sick, they don't want to feel cast adrift and unconnected with their employer anymore. So they will welcome, under appropriate circumstances, contact from their employer. And I think it's probably a legal obligation on employers in certain circumstances to keep in touch with employees when it comes to perhaps vacancies coming up. I'm thinking of women on maternity leave, for example. But keeping in touch with employees that are on long-term absence due to ill health is a way of keeping tabs on the likelihood of them coming back to work and talking to them about how they're progressing on the road to recovery. It's not a step to badgering people back into the workplace, or at least it shouldn't be a step to badgering people back into the workplace. So I would disagree with that employee who said, you know, calling me at home is harassment. It's good practice to set all this down in a policy, to discuss it with staff, to consult over what you will do in the circumstances of a long-term absence. People will then have a clear expectation about what will happen if they're off long-term sick. And when the phone call comes from their supervisor or their line manager, it's not a surprise. There will be trickier situations that employers will have to use their own discretion and judgment. If somebody's off work due to anxiety or some sort of mental health disorder, then, of course, an employer needs to play things a little more carefully.
Or if they had a phone phobia.
Sorry,
I'm being silly, but you know, I see.
In which case,
then you wouldn't, would you?
I'd
pop round with a note if that were me. Then.
Yeah, pop round with a note, send an email, whatever. Have this in your policy, and there's no surprises.
Yeah, Rebecca, any thoughts from that perspective?
Well, I think one of the problems is that employers tend to think that they can't win. So for those employees, some employees will like to be contacted at home. And if they're not, the first thing they'll do when they get back to work is say, I can't believe nobody ever contacted me. and some employees will categorically not want any work contact whatsoever. So employers are left in a position because they're looking at it very much from, oh, I'm not sure what I should do because this particular employee might not like it. And rather than having it in a policy and letting the employees know, as we've said, that if you're off for maybe 4 days or more, you will receive a call from your line manager. Mm. If you're off for 2 weeks or more, you will then receive a call from, you know, maybe the director of your particular business unit, and then you'll receive a home visit. So employees know that there is a structured pattern of care for them whilst they're away. Now, in terms of keeping in touch while they're away, one of the things that I do advise employers to do is, on an individual basis, if it looks like somebody is going to be off on a relatively long-term sickness absence, and I'm talking a week or more, is to actually try and agree with the employee what the level of contact is going to be, because each situation is going to be different. And you don't want a situation where an employee comes back to work and they do feel harassed. You haven't harassed them. There's no intention to harass. But you've got to bear in mind that particular employee. And if a very over-enthusiastic office manager decides to call them every day just to check, you know, how their latest ailment is, it's probably not going to go down very well. But, you know, every 3 or 4 days to perhaps call in, check every week, absolutely fine. But I do think that there should be an agreement, and particularly where we've got so many methods of communication now, it might be that rather than a phone call, it's an email. Mm. And most employees will be happy to email, let the employer know what's happening, and they may find that easier than a phone call.
We keep going back to this sort of, is this reasonable, don't we? And if we, I mean, we're going to touch on next week the whole idea of when it goes beyond being reasonable, and when maybe you're either taken to a tribunal or there's great discord. But it does seem to me that if you lay down what's reasonably expected, so that you can draw your employees' attention to that information, then you're starting out in a sensible way, aren't you?
Yeah. People will agree what is and what isn't reasonable, unless, of course, they are unreasonable.
And what's quite important...
Well, we'll talk about those next week.
And I think what's quite important from the policy point of view is the consistency element, because if one employee's been off and has never received a phone call, but another employee's been off and received several phone calls, one might feel slightly more loved than the other.
Yeah.
And that can create a whole host of issues, particularly in a smaller business where they feel that, well, they didn't care about me whilst I was off, but they made sure that, you know, Fred was called, you know, 3 times during his absence. Mm. What does that say about their attitude towards me as an employee?
So that's another word then. We've got reasonable and consistent. Mm-hmm. So the way the employer behaves has to be consistent across all employees.
Yes.
And that's one of the hardest things to actually achieve in a business.
Yes, because I'm thinking from the employer's aspect of having had some people who've been brilliant workers and they'll go the extra mile when I need them to. And then I've had others who are clock watching and you, it's human nature to treat those two individuals differently. And yet what I'm hearing is you mustn't. You must be consistent. You must be reasonable in the way that you deal with these different people.
Yeah. That way, employees will understand what to expect in certain circumstances. You know, right. It won't come down to my personal relationship or how the boss feels about me.
Yes. Okay, so they see it as reasonable.
They see it as reasonable. In Rebecca's example there, Fred may well have thought that all these phone calls were actually bullying and harassment to get him back to work. So, you know, there was a danger there. This is all about minimising the risk and trying to create a fair workplace, a felt fair workplace, where everybody sees that they're being treated in the same manner. You know, so if we're off sick, we will all get a 5-minute chat with the line manager on the day that we come back. You know, not just those people that traditionally may be viewed as swinging the lead.
I think this is the area, though. I can understand why so many business owners get unnerved by this, because it is, even though we're trying to say that it's clear if you're reasonable and you're this, the very words consistent and reasonable are woolly in themselves. Although they feel as if they're specific words, they're not applying to specific situations. As you just said, you know, what one person, your idea of reasonable won't be my idea and it won't be your idea, Rebecca. So I think that this is where possibly a lot of the that sort of latent fear that employers have, or probably employees as well, employers have all the time because of legislation. I think where some of this comes from that the idea that the words that we're using are in themselves difficult to define.
And they make it vague, so you feel that you're stepping into the unknown.
But without a safety net.
Well, without a safety net, I mean, my position would be there that I don't think anything can replace talking to your workforce and deciding amongst yourselves what is and what isn't reasonable. And if the mood of the workforce is to go towards a decision which is something the employer simply can't live with, well, then, okay, you've got to cross that bridge and maybe that's when you go to an external source of advice. But if it's stuff you can live with, then what you and your employees agree is what's healthy for your workplace, because it's you that's got to live with it at the end of the day.
Rebecca, from your perspective, as you know, that tripartite view you've got, you know, what else do you think is crucial for, you know, a listener who's a business owner and an employer as well, that they should really be aware of, a really important thing to think about when it comes to their responsibilities as an employer?
I would say address issues as they arise. Don't address issues 3 months down the line, particularly where it comes to performance. Because I'll give you an example. One of my pet hates is people who think they can't do anything until probation periods are up. So an employee's started and they've got a 3-month, a 6-month probationary period. And it's pretty obvious within the first month that this employee probably isn't going to cut it in the business. And yet many employers think they can't actually do anything, they can't address anything until the probationary meeting 3 months down the line. Well, that's ridiculous. You know, you address issues as they arise, because there might be something that you can do to turn around that employee and to save the recruitment fee you've just paid and avoid having to hire somebody else or have a gap in your business for a couple of months while somebody comes in. The training costs you've just incurred by bringing that employee in. But so many employers leave it too late. And leaving and not addressing performance will actually bring about almost a mark of acceptability of that employee's performance. So they think what they're doing is absolutely fine, where the employer's mumbling in the background about them to a colleague. And nobody wins there. So I think one of my very sort of clear messages is address issues as soon as they happen. Do not delay. And then address them with clear, straightforward, simple language. I've had a number of situations where people have been dismissed and the employer has dealt with the dismissal on the basis that actually the employee didn't know they were dismissed because the employer was so bad at communicating the message. Now, that's fairly extreme, but it's bringing somebody into a room and not wanting to actually use the word "you're dismissed," but using words like "let go," "not working out," those sorts of things.
Yeah.
So if you're going to address an issue, make sure the employee knows that you're addressing it and exactly what you're trying to communicate.
The problem we've got, though, in business is that people set up businesses. They then find that they can't do all the work themselves, so they need employees. But nobody taught them all those great skills that you need, the negotiation skills, the being clear, the understanding of the process. Nobody taught us that. And so we have to resort to, we don't have to resort to, but we do resort to woolly language because we're embarrassed and we don't really know the edges. We don't know the legal position. And I often, while doing this show, think about the poor harassed business owner, because I would, wouldn't I, as, you know, having done it for so many years, that there must be so many business owners who really want to get it right, but they don't know where to turn. So we're coming to the end of this part of the show, and I really like it if you can just say where you would send a listener to get rich information about the contract, about their responsibilities as an employer, about employees' rights.
For that hard-pressed employer that's created their own business because they wanted to create their own wealth and be their own boss, etc., suddenly finds themselves landed with this plethora of employment law. Think about either taking on your own legal advisor, having somebody on a call-off contract, or get yourself along to some ACAS training courses.
Excellent. Rebecca, as one of those specialists, you know, I know that I'm sure you have people ringing you up every day, either in a panic or thinking, you know, and usually probably after the horse has bolted or the employee has bolted. What would you be saying would be a good way to really steer a path through this maze?
Yes, well, sometimes we are seen as a distress purchase solicitors because people come to us after they have got it wrong. But what we're much keener to do is to help employers get it right. And we will point them to ACAS websites. We will point them to very good government websites. The BER websites are excellent.
We're going to cover next week what happens when it all goes wrong and how you can deal with it. But for now, thank you very much for coming in. This show was originally recorded for Business as Usual on Radio Reverb. I'm Julie Stanford. Thank you for listening to Essential Business Radio.